It's Wednesday, February the 9th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. As the Omicron wave continues to recede and the country looks towards what we all hope is the post-pandemic era, discussions have begun about how best to look at how the state dealt with the crisis, what worked, what didn't, and what lessons should be learned for the future. But Ireland's experiences of public inquiries have not been particularly happy in the past, so how might we avoid falling into the same traps again? And is there an urgency about getting the process underway while events are still fresh in people's minds? With me to discuss this are columnist Fintan O'Toole and Jack Horgan-Jones from our political staff, who I should mention is co-author of an impending book about Ireland during the pandemic. Hi, Jack. Hi, Fintan.
Hi, Hugh.
Good morning.
Jack, I should go to you first because I should mention that you've got a book in the pipeline on this subject.
It's very important to mention that. Feel free to mention it as often as you possibly can.
So that's coming out in about 2 months' time, I gather, and it's about the political handling of the pandemic itself.
Yeah, so myself and Hugh O'Connell, our colleague from the Irish Independent, have spent the guts of the last kind of 6, 7, 8 months pulling together this book, Pandemonium, the slugline for which is power, politics and the pandemic. And I suppose it's looking at, you know, how the state responded, really, how the political system responded, how the kind of different power dynamics and power relationships changed and shifted over time, and how those played into what was an extraordinary period of mobilisation of nearly every aspect of the state's resources, you know, the likes of which can only really be compared to, I think, a state of war. And, you know, hopefully we'll never see the like of it again, but I think it is likely that we will confront pathogens again. So part of it, part of what the book, I suppose, will try to do is establish what we did well, what we didn't do, what worked and what didn't. And I suppose after we've done that, the government will come along and the state itself will come along and perhaps try and establish what it did well and what it would not like to repeat.
Yeah, because it strikes me when thinking about this, I mean, I think we will come to the conclusion, well, I don't want to prejudge it, but that you know, that there is definitely need for an inquiry and we can discuss what its scope may be. But some of this work doesn't have to be done by the state. And in a way, you're doing some of that work in this book, certainly some of the initial groundwork, although I'm sure there are elements of things that you weren't able to get access to that the public do need to know about how decisions were made. But just, I suppose, at the outset here, your overview of the entire experience from the point of view of how Ireland as a society and a state handled it, are there things that jump out at you at things that we need to interrogate in order to learn lessons for the future?
Yes, where to start. My main takeaway, I suppose, is that you get one shot to confront a novel threat like this in the manner that we did. I think that our response was underpinned by dramatic intervention, both in terms of, you know, the fiscal response and the political response, which in turn was enabled by high degree of social cohesion and buy-in to the public health restrictions that were put in place, which itself in turn was probably driven by a large degree of fear and centred around this policy of lockdown. And we commissioned a piece of research for the book, which looked at just how stringent our lockdowns were. There's this kind of truism that we had the most restrictive measures in Europe, and that's not quite accurate, but we certainly had among the most, and I think for 81% of the time from March of 2020 to December of 2021, we had restrictions that were more onerous than the median in Europe. So we had the kind of centerpiece of the policy response, which was lockdown, and I don't think that it's possible to confront a threat again using something as blunt as lockdown. I think that the costs are too high. You know, in terms of, you know, interruption to education for kids, for example, or if you look at any other kind of policy area, let's take something that the government announced just this week, which is the retrofitting program. You look at the backlogs that were built up through that program, the investment in households that need retrofitting, who are suffering from fuel poverty, grew massively over the period of COVID. So I don't think that the state can organise itself to kind of waylay the rest of what it does in response to something that might come down the tracks again. So that's the key thing, I think, is thinking more closely about how we responded, about how we might respond again in the future to something like this without reaching for such a blunt policy intervention as lockdown, which was justified on its own terms and justified in terms of the scale of challenge that was facing us and the risk of sheer human death, but I don't think we'll be justified again for a second time, and I don't think we could rely on again the same extent of social cohesion and public buy-in that underpinned it all.
Well, I mean, that's all very interesting, Fintan, and maybe we'll come in a moment or in a little while to some of the concrete issues that we know were most salient during the lockdown. I think particularly of the some disastrous decisions made in relation to nursing homes in the early months, and obviously there are some, you know, there are questions about PPE procurement at a time of very heightened danger. I mean, those things in a way are more concrete, but this broader question of Ireland having been a country that relied more on lockdown and longer lockdowns than other countries, that seems to be a more difficult one to get our head around. Because I mean, I suppose we have to presume that the next crisis that comes is not going to be exactly the same crisis. So we have to draw a more abstract lesson about the way Ireland positions itself in response to things than just saying we won't lock down as longer the next time.
We certainly do. Yeah, you know. Because, of course, as Jack says, we don't know what the next time will be, right? So, you know, maybe lockdowns have to be worse. You know, we're in a situation where emergency events are becoming normal, you know, for all sorts of reasons, climate-related reasons particularly. So what we need in terms of an inquiry release is exactly that, to stand back and think, how do we do this stuff, rather than simply... you know, what precise things did we do right and wrong? We do need to do the latter, certainly. But there's a bigger question, really, which is about what is the state's structure for responding to deep emergencies like this? Let's remember that coming into this crisis, the state had a structure. It had spent a couple of years putting it in place. It was full of, you know, consultations and everybody had signed up to it. Leo Varadkar as Taoiseach, it was the Taoiseach who brought it in. And then it was immediately dumped when the pandemic came. You know, and this was, you know, that crises would be dealt with by the National Emergency Coordination Committee. And this whole system that was set up and everybody was kind of trained in this system, and then it was just kind of dumped. And we've never really had an explanation as to why that would be the case. And maybe that was right, maybe it was wrong. But one of the things we need to find out is, like, what was the thought process? You know, how were things constructed such that the first thing we did was throw out what we thought was the emergency management process, right? I think the second thing we really have to think about in terms of health emergencies is accountability, right? So we gave enormous power to NFET and particularly to the chief medical officer, Tony Holohan. I think it's probably fair to say that most citizens feel hugely grateful to those people, right, for the incredible effort they put in, you know, for taking on this burden. I think we're very fortunate in that we've had no indication of any kind of corruption or bad faith on the part of any of those people. You know, they behaved, so far as we know, impeccably with you know, a sense of the public interest as they saw it. But in any situation, you know, if a state hands over huge amounts of decision-making capacity, and let's be honest, it was decision-making, it wasn't just advice. The state hands that over to people who are not elected and for whom there is no real mechanism of accountability, you're going to get problems, right? It doesn't matter how wonderful the people are, they're human beings. There's going to be an element of groupthink, there's going to be an element of just what they narrowly focus on. So, for example, we saw very, very immediately with NFET that it was hospital focused, right? These were people who were coming from the hospital system by and large. That's what they were thinking about in terms of health. So all the focus was on hospitals and making sure that the hospital system didn't collapse. And the tragic consequence of that was that you know, NFET didn't discuss nursing homes for ages, didn't even talk about them, you know. And that tragedy was allowed to unfold because you didn't really have a mechanism for what should have been happening, which was governments coming in and saying, hold on a minute here, we've got a huge problem with nursing homes, let's focus on that, you know. So it's not just the concrete things, although I think there's a lot of concrete things to talk about. It's what are the democratic, accountable, flexible, fast-moving kinds of mechanisms that we need for coping with potentially existential crisis?
Yeah, I mean, those are both very interesting points. They're interlinked, Jack. It strikes me that if you get to the nub of, maybe you did get an answer in your book for this, you know, of why didn't they use the existing emergency mechanism? I suspect the answer would be because it was an emergency, which is obviously not very satisfactory.
But the other thing has emergency in its title.
I know. But the other thing that strikes me is a few months ago, we had the writer and historian Neil Ferguson on the podcast who has written a book about disasters called Doom, including some stuff about the pandemic. And one of his critiques, and he comes from a particular political perspective, was that the country in the world that was supposed to be best prepared for these kinds of things was the United States. Now, we know there were particular problems there, particularly at the time, but also the institutional structures that were supposed to be so developed so able to cope with these emergencies really coped extremely badly. The Centers for Disease Control's approach to testing kind of put America behind the eight ball before they'd even started on things. They were too rigid. They were too bureaucratic. And Ferguson's argument is that these kinds of plans are put together by bureaucracies to justify their existence. But when they collide into harsh reality, they very often are not fit for purpose, and you might be better off being more flexible and, you know, bringing it all back into government. And I wonder, in your opinion, do you think that's what happened here?
Yes, broadly speaking, I do. So the group that Fintan referred to is one of these things that it's kind of great on paper, and then, as you say, reality emerges and it's much more shocking and disorientating, and probably more of a kind of corporeal threat and a threat to life than people previously imagined. Because I would say when they were sitting down to think of what the NECG could do, and you know, they threw pandemic response in there, they were probably thinking about pandemics like SARS or MERS or some of these other diseases that, you know, were looked like they might be a big problem, but then kind of fizzled out because they were either too deadly or, you know, didn't make the leap across between people from a transmissibility point of view too effectively. So I think that there was a kind of sense within public administration generally, including the Irish public administration, that, you know, pandemics were something that were threats that never really crystallized, you know. And then when this did, and it came at such a pace and was so shocking, the idea that it would be confronted with some kind of happy, flat pack approach that neatly fit into the threat that was being faced quickly evaporated. But I think that's of secondary importance. What's of more primary importance is the kind of political economy that existed around the Irish system at the time, and the model of decision making that emerged. And I don't think that we can really get away from the fact that we were just coming out of an election at the time, that we had a caretaker government in place. In that situation, we were faced with this kind of novel threat, and there was a massive centralization of power, not even into just the Department of Health, I think into the Department of the Taoiseach, and the very top people at the Department of the Taoiseach, Martin Fraser, the Secretary General to the government, and his team around him, the very top politicians and the very top of the HSE, and also the NEFIT structure that was just set up then. So I think that, you know, the fact that emerged and emerged so quickly didn't sit very well with this pre-existing idea, which I think is actually run under the auspices of the Department of Housing. Because they had to move, they felt they had to move so very quickly and organise things to just the one end point, that they didn't have time effectively, I think was the view, to be messing around with these external structures or these pre-existing structures. You know, it had to be done, it had to be done now, and it had to be done with this almost kind of diktat authority that can only really flow from the very highest offices in the land, you know. And that's why I think we ended up with this model. And also, I think one of the most important things that emerged at the very start was the degree to which we were in lockstep with our public health advice. It was absolutely one and the same. Now, the public health advice was flawed in its own way, in that it probably didn't grasp the seriousness of the threat. I mean, in the middle of February, we were still telling ourselves we'd have little outbreaks of the disease here and there, but largely it was probably going to be controlled and controllable, whereas we know in retrospect that the disease was already in the country and spreading in a fashion that was undetected by our by our systems of public health surveillance. So while the public health advice was flawed, there was this kind of synchronicity between the political system in the early stage and the public health advice. They moved very much in lockstep, and that's kind of one of the determining factors of the early stages of the response. How that changed over time and the degree of buyer's regret that evolved within government over the power and the primacy that was given to Neffet and to Tony Holohan is another element that unfolded over time, and is why this is such an interesting and fascinating study in kind of the power dynamics of policy formulation under, you know, totally unprecedented and unimaginable pressures.
Just in relation to that, Fintan, and then to what happened as a consequence with the nursing homes, I mean, clearly, because of the sort of the particular political circumstances which Jack describes there, we ended up with this sort of technocratic government, essentially, for 3 or 4 months at the outset, and probably the scariest point of the whole crisis, when we knew so little about the disease and how to cope with it. But one of the things about our public inquiry is one presumes there will be similar public inquiries taking place in countries all over the world. And there is surely some knowledge and some wisdom to be derived from those parallel processes. So while we can point at the preeminence of the medical establishment in the decisions that led to the disaster that happened in our nursing homes, exactly the same thing happened in a range of other countries, which have somewhat different systems. So it wasn't something that was necessarily particular or peculiar to Ireland, although it did perhaps reflect the way in which decisions were made and the way in which voices at the table in different countries were heard and other ones weren't. It's not peculiar to us.
I think that's absolutely true. And in fact, I would say one of the great weaknesses of our system all the way through the pandemic was the refusal to actually learn from what was happening anywhere else. It was as if there was an Irish pandemic, you know, that the virus was somehow, you know, hitting us. And we saw it through a framework of you know, Irish policymaking and Irish society. I mean, the underlying, and I don't think it's too strong a word to say, but a kind of unconscious racism, you know, which said, well, we've nothing to learn from the East. and it wasn't even nothing to learn. It was that, you know, the stuff they're doing in China, Vietnam, Taiwan. Eastern people would put up with that, but we really wouldn't. You know, we're different somehow. We wouldn't wear masks. We wouldn't endure lockdowns, you know. And that was all, that's 19th century Orientalism. I mean, it's pure kind of, you know, the Orient, you know, the Oriental people are different and they're kind of submissive and subservient and they'll put up with this stuff. There was a lot of that kind of nonsense, you know, and in different ways it continued, right, which is just refusing to see this as precisely, as you say, as an international global pandemic. And that's what a pandemic means, isn't it? And so yes, we shouldn't repeat that, right, now trying to think about it as the Irish pandemic and what went wrong and what didn't. The underlying, some of the lessons here are not mysterious, right? And but we've had, I don't want to be tasteless in using a kind of parallel, but like that, if you think about the Great Famine, for example, that's the biggest catastrophe that Ireland's ever experienced. What does that tell us, right? What it tells us, is what all famines tell us, is that the people who get most affected and who die in these crises are the weak, are the people who don't have a voice, and the people who don't have political power, right? That's why, you know, I mean, if the Irish famine had been happening in London, you know, responses would have been very, very different. If it had been happening even in different parts of Ireland, you know, it happened in the parts of Ireland where you had huge vulnerable Irish-speaking populations who just didn't have political power. And that's true of famines all over the world, you know, that's what's repeated, right? It's not about lack of food, it's about lack of power. And so what was true of Ireland was true of a lot of other societies, right? Which is that if you segregate older people from society, you deprive them of a political voice. You know, they're out of sight, out of mind, turned out to be not just a cliche in this crisis, but a deadly one, you know, one that actually was completely true. So you had people screaming about what was going on in the nursing homes. It wasn't like that it was unknown. It was just, as you said, that the people who were being most affected just didn't have any kind of purchase on the public imagination and on the political system, right? Until it was very, very late in the day. So the underlying thing we have to think about in relation to this is how we structure social care, you know? Like, just a very simple thing. We know from study after study after study will tell you that the vast majority of older people want to be kept in their own communities and preferably in their own homes, right? We know that there's ways of doing this, and we just don't do it, right? The institutional and economic logic is all about sort of segregating people and putting them into often kind of private businesses. Basically, they become a resource for private businesses. We shouldn't be doing it that way. You know, there are some people who need quasi institutional care. Most people don't. You know, and so thinking about how we do care, you know, is absolutely crucial. If there's anything is going to be learned from this, and you know, the need to do it very differently is very obvious, I think.
So that brings me to a broader question, or a broader concern on my part, Jack, which is that this pandemic was one of the biggest events in my life. It was one of the biggest events in the history of the state. There's an awful lot you could talk about and an awful lot of lessons you could learn. And the single biggest tragedy within it was what happened in the nursing homes, it seems to me, and that's true. But it also had hugely significant impact in the way we live, on the way we work, on the way our cities are shaped, on the way our transport infrastructure works. And are those things that can or should be brought into a review or an inquiry, or I think Micheál Martin preferred the word evaluation, which seems maybe a little bit too gentle. Or will that just get too diffuse? And do we just need to drill down and focus on half a dozen, you know, important, tangible things?
There's a couple of things that strike me. I mean, you say that it was a chance, I suppose, for us to consider wider questions of the way in which we live. And, you know, I think that that's true. I think that it's pretty doubtful as to whether we will extract any of those lessons and put them into practice. I think that, you know, other than an approach to hybrid working, which seems to be pretty deeply embedded, which is a big thing in and of itself, I think that, you know, the opportunity presented by the pandemic, terrible and all as it was, for kind of gross reformation of how we do service provision or, you know, public policy formation or anything like that, I don't see any evidence of that being grasped. Like, take, for example, the Leaving Cert. You know, the Leaving Cert was, it became a weird shadow version of itself, which pleased no one for a couple of years. And I think that in the round, it's probably better that it's going back to the old normal than staying in the kind of hybrid model that existed. But it was also a big opportunity for reform. You know, I don't think anyone thinks that the Leaving Cert is an optimal way of evaluating how people do in school and filtering them through into university. And it seems to me that the opportunity for substantial reform seems to have passed us by. And I think that there's a wider risk of that happening across many different spheres of life. Like, it looked for a time that the kind of increasing urbanisation of the state and the concentration of that urbanisation largely within the capital might be offset by remote working and people moving to remote hubs or regional cities. Again, that looks to have turned turtle pretty quickly after the quote-unquote end of the pandemic. You know, we see even this morning that property prices are rampant again in the cities and receding in the regions. So I think that we may look back, and when it comes to that kind of broader structural piece of changing how we live our lives, I think that we may look at it as a missed opportunity, and potentially we won't have those conversations as well, because the pandemic was so traumatic for so many people. I think that people kind of, they don't, now that it seems to be in abeyance, they don't want to kind of engage with it. I think that there's certainly going to be a period of a few months where, if the disease from a kind of epidemiological perspective doesn't force itself back to the center of the discourse, we just won't think about it. We just won't talk about it, because it was such an unpleasant time. And maybe only in a few months or even in a year or more, we'll try and kind of grapple with what it meant and extract lessons from it. I think that there's, and I think that that's actually, to bring it full circle to where we started, to talk about, you know, a public inquiry or the political response or the state response to what we learned. I think that the government is very much leaning into that at the moment. You know, they know that there's this kind of period of abeyance or period of hiatus, and they don't seem to be in a particular rush to do anything in terms of a commission of inquiry or an Oireachtas committee or an expert group. They're letting it breathe, for want of a better word. And talking to even people across government this morning, they're very much kind of slow playing it and saying, you know, we're only 2 weeks out from the lifting of restrictions. The pandemic state, as designated by the WHO, still exists both in Ireland and around the world. So perhaps now is not the time. There's also a fear, I think, of, you know, this process becoming overly politicised. And I think they look back to the post-financial crash reckoning. And the most visible form that took, which was the banking inquiry that ran from 2015 and into 2016, I think, maybe 2014 and into 2015. Either way, it wasn't seen to do a very good job. It became kind of really trammelled by process, very legalistic and very politicised as well, and also had this element of kind of show trial to it. So I think there's a real eagerness to avoid doing that again. I think that eagerness is partially supported by the fact that, you know, people don't necessarily fit neatly into the category of goodies and baddies after this disaster, after this crisis, in the way they did after the financial crisis. I mean, after the financial crisis, we were demonstrably one of the worst performers in the world. We had a cast of regulators and bankers and politicians who had been objectively asleep at the wheel. After this crisis, we seem to have come out kind of middle of the pack, both in terms of absolute deaths and excess deaths. There were definitely weaknesses in how we constructed our set of pandemic policies and managed all those power relationships and all the rest of it. But, like, you know, was it this kind of conflagration that existed in Brazil or the United States or the United Kingdom? I don't think so. So they're trying to square all that and also trying to, like, head off the very real political risk that does exist to this government, constituent parts of which have been in power for the entirety of the pandemic. Because even though, you know, we didn't have a disastrous pandemic, there are real questions for them to answer. The nursing homes one is one. Particularly how the nursing homes issue happened in March, April and May of 2020. And then after we knew what COVID could do, happened again in January and February of 2021 with, I think, an equal, if not greater, death toll attached to it. An associated question which this government has to face and may be uncomfortable for it is the set of decisions that it took around Christmas 2020, allowing the degree of social mixing, which led to the explosion in cases and transmission, which in turn led to that disastrous third wave, which was in many ways, in fact, in almost every way, worse than the first wave. So the fact that we ended up with a worse iteration faced by the same virus, albeit containing a kind of element of one variant of the virus in the third wave, the fact that happened again, knowing what we knew at that stage, I think is a politically problematic question for the government. So it's perhaps no surprise that they want to kick it to touch for a little while and see where the chips fall and see what the kind of optimum political mode for addressing the history of the pandemic is for them.
So is there a way of doing this, Fintan, that is better than some of the previous inquiries to which Jack referred there, where you don't have a situation where everybody lawyers up and where you're going to the High Court every couple of weeks and all that kind of stuff, where you can kind of set the ground rules at the outset to make it clear that you're not looking for heads and it's not a political showboating exercise and that it is actually, we're seeking to educate ourselves about our mistakes in order not to make them in the future, and that's it. Is there a way of doing that within our system? Because I haven't seen it previously.
Well, oddly, perhaps the very weakness of our system of public inquiries might be a benefit in this regard, which is that, I mean, almost every other democracy, right, has serious businesses of parliamentary inquiries, right? We don't have them. Why? Because the legal system decided to, frankly, to monopolize the power of inquiry, right? The legal system has made sure that you have to lawyer up, you know, and that the whole thing is conducted through lawyers, which makes it then incredibly expensive, incredibly slow, and incredibly adversarial. Our system is one in which the courts have essentially nobbled parliamentary inquiry, right? Cannot find any findings that are adverse to any individual, right? You know? However, perhaps that might not be such an issue with this, right? Because as you said, this is not about looking for heads, right? There is no scandal here as such, right? There's no sense, so far as we know, right, that there was any malign intent or action on the part of individuals which led to this crisis or the bad handling of the crisis, right? So far as we know, everybody was acting in good faith, right? And that then means that we don't need an inquiry which says, why did X, you know, do or fail to do Y? What we need is an inquiry which actually just establishes a kind of narrative of what happened, you know, and why, and allows those individuals actually to tell their stories in public. We know, and I'm sure Jack's book will contain a lot more of this, but like we know, for example, that members of ENFET have a lot to say themselves about how ridiculous the situation was that they were left in, where they were making the decisions. You know, some of them have gone on record saying this, you know, that this was ludicrous, you know, that this power that they were given was just completely wrong. We need to hear that in a sort of more structured, open way. There needs to be a process in which a sort of narrative can be established, right? Like just simple things like why masks were bad? Like what was the thinking there? You know, how did we get into a situation whereby the ENFET was actively working against masks, even on public transport, at a point where the poor, unfortunate bus workers, for example, were pleading, were saying, like, we're being left here to get COVID. We're just being left out there as sacrificial lambs. Could you not ask people or, you know, tell people they have to wear masks on public transport? No, wouldn't be a good idea. For weeks and weeks, what happened with the madness about antigen tests? Like why uniquely in the Western world? Like, were antigen tests bad in Ireland but good everywhere else? You know, like these are questions which need to be answered, you know, and they need to be answered simply because it's a process of public accountability. You know, like, I mean, even if, like, there are all those big, big questions that you were talking to Jack about, quite rightly, you know, about the education system, about the healthcare system, about commuting and remote work. And there's lots of social questions to be asked. That's not what this inquiry really should focus on. This inquiry just needs to present a public narrative, right? If you have something as big as this in any society, that society has to produce an official narrative, right? Even regiments in wars, right, produce an official narrative of this is what we did in the, you know, the Ardennes campaign. This is how it worked. This is what went wrong. This is what went right. Why? Because actually, you know, whatever chance you have of being prepared for the next time, you've no chance at all if you don't have a map. You don't have something saying, okay, this is how it worked. And you know, so even apart from the kind of concrete lessons, it's a fundamental issue of democracy. You know, we de-democratized the handling of the pandemic. Governments became very, well, at once too strong in that, you know, it was top-down diktat, but also incredibly weak, right, in that it was essentially doing what it was told by ENFET. That's a really serious democratic deficit, and it's up to the eructus, right? I don't want a judge. I don't want a foreign consultant doing, you know, for all its faults and failures, we elect an eructus to do this. That's the constitutional duty lies with the eructus to exert accountability, right? And if the eructus isn't capable of doing this, then we're in a really, really serious democratic problem. You know, and if they're going to politicize it to such an extent that it becomes a show trial, then shame on them. And but that's also something we need to know, right? It's very important for us as a society. If the answer is, you can go through one of the biggest crises in the post-war history of the state, and our elected parliament is incapable of conducting any exercise in accountability, I mean, that would be something worth knowing, you know. But I'm slightly more optimistic, because actually when you get into the business of it, it actually doesn't become, as Jack was saying, I think Jack's, it's not about good guys and bad guys, right? It's about what happened and why it happened. And surely be to God, there's a capacity to lay down a basic narrative. Even the banking inquiry, flawed as it is actually useful, right? It does lay down a narrative, right? It does tell us some stuff, which is important. I think this could be better than the banking inquiry for those reasons that we don't have the white hats and the black hats, and we don't have, you know, a kind of binary here. We just need a public accounting of what happened.
This is a politics podcast, so we're interested in the politics of things in general. And in many countries, partisan politics was at the heart of the debate over how COVID should be dealt with. And in many, or certainly in some countries, that had a very negative impact on the ability of that society to deal with the threat which COVID posed. And that seemed to be, Jack, much less of the case here. There seemed to be quite a lot of consensus. There was a lot of buy-in into things like the vaccines. There was a lot of buy-in to the, you know, the very serious restrictions which were imposed on people's liberties. But there does seem to be a kind of a paradox in relation to some of the things Fintan was saying there, that you had all that and you didn't really have the mass protests against restrictions that you've seen in other countries, or political parties coming out in a strong way against them. But yet you did seem to have this deep distrust on the part of the authorities, which is what led to particularly long lockdowns, the question of masks, both the issue of masks, which Fintan refers to, and the issue of antigens, both seem to be rooted in a distrust on the part of the medical authorities that the population would use these things properly. It tells us something about the way power and society works in Ireland.
Yeah, and I think that those two examples are interesting ones, and they speak to a lot of kind of themes within the pandemic, if you'll indulge me for a moment, one of which is the kind of paternalism that is inherent perhaps in the medical profession, and to maybe even a greater extent within public health, you know, which studies and tries to evaluate and predict and cater for how people interact with medicine and medical threats at a kind of population level as opposed to an individual level. And, you know, that makes it, I think, particularly susceptible to fears about interventions which may be mishandled by a small kind of subset of the population, and that can kind of, you know, transmogrify into a big issue, you know. So I think that, like, they're always led by, or they want the cover of, you know, a large body of evidence over something like mask wearing, which just didn't exist in the early days of the pandemic, even though the horse sense was accurate, which is that, of course, wearing masks is going to help stop this thing. But they kind of held back and they said, no, we want total certainty flowing from research, which empirically shows this is the case, and, you know, that was damaging.
But there was also a suspicion that this would give people a sense of carte
blanche. People mishandled them.
They would then think that they could break all the rules because they had a mask.
Yeah, we all remember these, like the messaging, and looking back, you know, to when they actually changed their advice on masks, it was still shot through with this kind of paternalistic message. You have Tony Holland saying things like, "Now they're not a magic shield," and of course, I don't think that, like, most people really felt that they were a magic shield, you know. And we had these kind of really kind of didactic videos on, you know, how to take it off without touching it, and, you know, is there a risk that people will touch the mask and spread the virus arising from that, you know. And then you have the issue of antigen, which is, like, just, I think, the most fascinating study in the kind of paradynamics of the pandemic in Ireland, because it became this kind of political cause célèbre during 2021 in particular, as we kind of came out of that super long lockdown that followed the third wave. The political system took it up. Stephen Donnelly in particular took it up and was its champion, to the extent that he actually set up a group to study how it would be used and implemented, which existed outside the kind of healthcare establishment. It existed outside the HSE, whose responsibility it would be for implementing these things. It existed outside NPHET, whose responsibility it is for formulating policy that goes to government, and yet was, by and large, for much of the year, entirely unsuccessful in getting this launched to any appreciable degree. And that showed, I think, the ingrained power that exists within the healthcare establishment versus the fleeting power of the political system, you know, because they can effectively say, look, go off, make up your policy, commission your external report, but good luck getting that implemented when we actually are the nuts and bolts people on the ground, and we're the ones who are going to run you know, the rollout of this. So I think that's a fascinating little sub episode that illuminates a great deal about Ireland's pandemic. And there's if you'll allow me a short plug, there's a great deal on this in the book and a great deal of new material showing how that evolved over time. And you know, one of the things that I think Fintan said, and it's absolutely true, is that, like, even though we came through this, you know, as I say, middle of the pack, not a disaster, not a burning dumpster fire in terms of, you know, the human toll of the pandemic, it does raise really profound questions about how democratic the approach was, what the state is of political power within the state, and how that compares to what we saw, which was a great expression of the power of the state itself, but not necessarily the political system. And you talk to people on NPHET, you talk to people within government, and I think there is a wide acknowledgement that the way that we went about formulating pandemic policy was absolutely insane. It was, you know, the boffins go into a room, there's a drumbeat over weeks of what they might decide on, huge amounts of punditry and speculation. They go into a room separate from the political system, who don't really have an input into it. They formulate the advice. It then comes out, usually leaked by one side or the other, almost immediately, and the political system is asked to react to that. Now, like, as I've said before on this podcast, that's a mad way of deciding, you know, any form of policy. It's a mad way of deciding, you know, what kind of bus you buy for the public transport fleet. It's a totally mad way of deciding something as all-encompassing as pandemic policy, you know, which was the be-all and end-all, the centre of the news agenda, the centre of the political and policy agenda for the guts of 2 years. So, you know, that model, I think, needs to be more closely interrogated. And that democratic deficit that definitely existed has to be closely interrogated. And I think Fintan is right. The degree to which the political system can reassert its agency over, you know, the inquiry process, and the degree to which the whip hand is held by the political system, I think, is a kind of acid test for that. Because I don't think it's one of these things that we can just kind of kick to touch to an expert inquiry. I think that probably is what the government wants to do. They probably want something like the Scally report after cervical check, or something even to go back to the financial crisis again. Remember the Nyborg report or the Honohan report, you know, something that exists behind closed doors, produces something that is kind of fungible and useful and all the rest of it. But I think it's important that there is this kind of cathartic moment, that, you know, there is a public reckoning in some way, shape or form, and that the Oireachtas, that the Dáil and the Seanad are involved in that. I think that the government, if they try not to have that part of it, I think they'll risk a backlash coming through the Oireachtas itself. At least I hope that there'll be a backlash coming through the Oireachtas itself, and that you might see committees, already extant committees, which have a legitimate claim over invigilating parts of the response, like the Health Committee or a Public Accounts Committee, stepping forward and saying, well, look, we're going to do a module on this. We're going to do this. We're going to reassert. Because I think it is important to have that rebalancing now, because it's an important point for politics, an important point for, you know, assessing how politics and the state interact going forward.
Last question to you, Fintan. We were talking recently about your book, your recent memoir, stroke History of Modern Ireland, and the Ireland of 2022, which Jack describes there, sort of slightly chaotic on the front end, highly paternalistic on the back, quite cohesive, and also quite quiescent and obedient. It reminds me of the Ireland you described in 1958 in some sense. You can sort of see a through line there, can't you?
You definitely can, you know. One bit of the story is very good, right? So you know, we're both old enough to remember Bertie Ahern lamenting the collapse of social capital in Ireland, you know, in the Celtic Tiger years, and set up a commission on social capital. I don't know if you remember that one, you know, which produced a report about how, you know, cohesion in Irish society was falling apart and, you know, all that stuff. And of course, it turned out to be untrue, right? So social cohesion was actually completely remarkable, you know, both in terms of the early days of the pandemic, just in terms of, you know, voluntary effort. You know, every community in Ireland, you know, where you had the local football club, the local GAA club, the local flower arranging society, whatever, you know, going around to older people in the community and saying, what do you need? What can we do? What, you know, have you got somebody to do your shopping? You know, just that basic kind of stuff was absolutely wonderful. And also then, in terms of like the wild Irish are gone. You're like, you know, this notion of, you know, oh, you know, we're sort of wild, roguish kind of nation. Well, you know, no, actually, we're very obedient. You know, but actually, that was not a bad thing. It was a real sense of actually people, the vast majority of people understood, even though the authorities and the healthcare authorities thought we were idiots, understood that, you know, there was mutual interest. Like the enlightened self-interest really kicked in. People understood that if I follow the rules, it's good for me and it's good for my neighbors, it's good for my family, it's good for my granny. You know, that sense of kind of cooperation actually was very, very strong and very important. The bad side of it was that, yes, absolutely, the other thing we still have is this sort of authoritarian system top down. I mean, you could see the NFET as just kind of replacing the, you know, the annual meeting of the bishops in Maynooth or something, you know, where things were decided. And by the way, the maleness of it, very much of the public face of this, is something we haven't talked about. Like, Jesus, I mean, at least one thing we should never, ever do again, you know, is have a public emergency in which time after time after time, you've got five or six blokes in suits standing up telling people, you know, what's going on and what to do, and completely ignoring, you know, the worries that pregnant women had, completely ignoring questions, you know, just really simple questions like, you know, giving birth in the pandemic, like what would that be like, treating, you know, partners, male partners, as if they were sort of awkward alien visitors who were going to bring a virus into a hospital rather than as part of the system. I mean, there's a whole set of questions right around gender, which were completely 1950s. It was completely as if, you know, we just had these middle-aged men in suits, you know, issuing diktats and issuing pastoral letters, you know. So they're, I think for both and good and bad reasons, a lot of this stuff seemed very familiar, you know. And if we are going to come out of it with anything positive, I think it's first of all to reinforce that good side of it, right? To actually think about, why was it that in some ways the society was vastly better than those in charge thought it was going to be? Much more intelligent, much more cooperative, much more, you know, driven by this sense of an enlightened understanding that, you know, we were all in this together. How do you reinforce that? How do you reinforce those kind of social strengths? But also the bad side of it, right? Which is, you know, is our only way of dealing with emergencies to have blokes in a room, you know, and you know, I think Jack described it brilliantly, this sort of weird process whereby, you know, what they've decided is leaked, and then the political system has to react to that, and then all of us in the media are saying, oh, but NFET has already decided that you should be doing this, you know, taking complete agency out of the entire political system. And actually, this is up to our politicians, actually. You know, just at a really basic level, I completely agree with Jack. You know, the political system, if it has any sense of self-worth, self-esteem, you know, has to reestablish itself as, you know, an important part of our democracy. You know, this is the way we're supposed to do things. And it has to do this by showing that it's capable of conducting a serious, fair-minded, non-partisan inquiry or evaluation of what happened throughout this whole process. And if it were able to produce that in a way that actually was intelligent, fair-minded, and accessible to the public, I think it would go some way towards reestablishing the idea that we're supposed to be a republican democracy.
I think we can all agree with that. I think we can also all agree that we also need really well-written books that inform us about the subject. What was the name of that book again, Jack?
Pandemonium, out late April, but available to pre-order now.
Okay, so keep an eye out for that. Listen, we will leave it there for today. Thanks so much to Fintan and to Jack for joining us. Thanks to Declan Conlon, our producer. We're going to be back very soon. Remember, you can mail us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.